Over the next few months, Boise State Public Radio and the Idaho Statesman will be teaming up to examine mental health in Idaho. The latest report in the collaboration is out today. Idaho Statesman reporter Audrey Dutton joins me in the studio this morning to talk about it. Good morning, Audrey.
Good morning.
So before we get into the details of today's news story, let's talk a little bit about the project as a whole. Can you give us a feel for what it's about?
Sure. So Emily Ritter Saunders, who's a reporter here, and I started talking in the spring about Idaho's mental health situation. We know, for example, that Idaho has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation. We know there's a shortage in psychiatric care, but we wanted to dig deeper. So we decided to work together and shed some more light on a topic we're both very interested in.
What kind of topics do you plan on covering?
We've heard a lot of complaints, as have other news organizations, about Optum, which is the company Idaho hired a year ago to run its Medicaid mental health and substance abuse program. Optum essentially plays the role of a health insurance company for Idaho's Medicaid patients. Our first two stories in this collaboration deal with some of those complaints. Today's story is about allegations that Optum has violated the federal law known as HIPAA, which is meant to protect patients' privacy. One of the people we've talked to already is Chris Culp, who is the Chief Operations Officer for Idaho Behavioral Health, an agency in Boise.
And we've been getting reports back that has the names of patients that we're not familiar with, or the names of a therapist that we're not affiliated with. And I've also gotten from other agencies phone calls and evidence that they've received information on our patients and their remittance advice, or they've received information about our therapists on their RA.
After hearing from Culp and others like him, I requested public records from state and federal agencies. They showed that similar complaints had been filed over the past year or so. The federal agency that's in charge of enforcing the privacy law responded saying it has opened an investigation into those complaints.
About how many complaints have there been?
I don't know for sure. I only know that it's at least a dozen complaints and that they cover multiple instances.
And what kind of patient information has gone to the wrong places?
Patient names and the services they were provided, basically. A lot more information went to the wrong providers, but those are the ones that they were concerned about. So the services could be psychotherapy, medication management, other rehabilitation service.
Audrey, from what you've been able to figure out, have you been able to tell if Optum did in fact break HIPAA laws?
Well, that's what the federal investigation is meant to determine. The Idaho Department of Health and Welfare said the HIPAA law carves out some exemptions that these kinds of complaints seem to fall into, so it didn't report them as HIPAA privacy breaches.
There are exemptions then?
Yes. The HIPAA law actually only applies to certain people. So if I do an interview about chickenpox with someone who has it, I don't need them to sign a HIPAA waiver. But if a hospital told me about that same person's chickenpox without their permission, that hospital would probably be in some trouble. The complaints in this story are in a much more gray area, I think.
But there's enough smoke here, I guess, that the federal government at least thinks it's worth investigating or taking some sort of closer look.
Right. And in the majority of cases, the feds don't pursue an investigation when someone files a HIPAA complaint because they look at it early on and they say, this isn't a problem, or this doesn't even qualify for an investigation. The agency that's investigating, the Office for Civil Rights, gets thousands of complaints every year, and a portion of them get investigated. Of those, about two-thirds end up being a problem and have to be resolved in some way. Optum also says it's taken these very seriously and conducted its own internal investigations.
Yeah, you have talked to Optum. What else do they say about this whole matter?
Well, Optum Executive Director Becky DeVittorio told me they have confirmed 134 incidents. She also points out that they've processed 1.3 million claims. So that's 1/100th of a percent, a fraction. She adds that they take this issue very seriously. They don't believe there were actually any privacy breaches, and they say that they've made fixes to prevent the human error that caused the information to go to the wrong providers.
So they admit to sending patients' information to the wrong providers, but at the same time, they do not think that was a violation.
Correct. Optum basically contends that the providers who were sent the wrong information are themselves covered under HIPAA, and therefore the information should be considered safe.
And you can get more details by picking up today's Idaho Statesman, visiting the Statesman website, or reading online at boisestatepublicradio.org. Audrey Dutton, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Idaho's effort to rein in Medicaid costs while improving care is creating friction among the state's mental health care providers and the company Idaho hired last year to manage the system. The state is paying Optum Idaho more than $10 million a month to approve payments to behavioral and mental health care providers who care for Medicaid patients. As Emily Ritter-Saunders explains, providers say they're struggling to pay their employees and care for their patients as glitches in Optum's payment system continue.
Over the last several weeks, Optum has been erroneously sending claims payments to providers in amounts like 5, 7, and 11 cents. The company categorizes the small remittances as a one-time glitch that's been fixed. But two of the Treasure Valley's largest mental health care providers for Medicaid patients say these tiny payments have been a problem throughout Optum's first 11 months in Idaho. Nikki George is the owner of Access Behavioral Health in Boise. In the case of her business, Optum would pay the small remittance within the 30 days its state contract requires. Then the balance of the claim is paid weeks, sometimes months, later.
Because whatever we get from Optum is the money that we directly use to pay our employees. And if we send in a claim for $60, we're paying our employees $40 of that. And if we only get paid 5 cents, then we don't have any money to pay our employees.
George says she hasn't had to cut back on services for patients yet, but she has taken out loans in order to be able to pay her employees while she waits for claims payments. At Idaho Behavioral Health in Boise, CEO Tammy Jones says her company has had to add people in its billing department just to ensure Optum is paying correctly. Like George, Jones has taken out lines of credit to stay in business.
And this is really hurting the smaller agencies where they don't have the resources available to increase their billing department. The mom and pop shops where mom's the one doing the billing, she now has no time to go out and see clients because she's having to spend all of her time chasing the pennies.
Optum contends it is operating within its state contract, which requires it to pay 90% of claims on time and accurately within 30 days. An Optum spokesman said in an email the company is exceeding that requirement with a 99% accuracy rate. The state's contract manager, the Department of Health and Welfare, agrees. The department's behavioral health administrator, Ross Edmonds, says glitches are to be expected as the state transitions into its new managed care system.
I would suggest to you that every single state that has implemented managed care in their Medicaid benefit has experienced challenges in those first couple of years of implementing it.
Some providers, though, don't have the financial ability to weather the storm. At least one has already closed, citing tiny claims payments as one reason. For KBSX News, I'm Emily Ritter-Saunders.
Nearly a quarter of Idahoans are living with a mental illness. Often, those people don't end up getting the kind of care they need until they're in crisis. It's social workers and police officers who find themselves on the front lines of mental health crisis care in Idaho. That's partly because funding for preventative care has declined. The National Alliance on Mental Illness says state governments have slashed funding for mental health care by more than $4 billion since 2009. As Emily Ritter-Saunders explains, during that same time period, the number of Idahoans put on involuntary mental holds has grown by 40%.
2 years ago, Philip Mazaikas answered a knock at his front door that would change the course of his life. At 24 years old, Mazaikas was in the middle of his first psychotic episode, and social worker Teresa Shackelford witnessed it.
I was just storming around the house, really angry, when I heard a knock at the door. I remember thinking to myself, like, stay cool, stay cool. Just act normal. Like, whoever it is, don't say anything about aliens, because they'll think you're crazy.
We responded to the home, which was actually the family home. And the parents had moved out just temporarily because the behavior was so alarming and kind of threatening.
I answer the door, and there's two police officers and two women. It's Teresa and Ellie. Basically, I just started saying, you know, I'm having a great day.
Philip was very friendly and talkative at first.
And then it just really hit me. Like, it meant so much to me that I thought I was contacted by aliens. That's something that I felt almost evangelical about sharing. I also told him I recently drank my own urine.
What he was talking about was very bizarre and disorganized. He was having some disturbing hallucinations and delusions.
That was the first day Mazaikas met Shackelford, who now manages a regional mobile crisis unit for the state health department. Shackelford's job is to de-escalate potentially dangerous situations and to see if a person qualifies for a mental hold or involuntary commitment into a state hospital. In this case, Mazaikas did. She and her colleagues are often doing their job alongside law enforcement or first responders. Sergeant David Cavanaugh manages the Boise Police Department's Crisis Intervention Team, or CIT. He says all Idaho police officers receive basic de-escalation training, but of BPD's 286 sworn officers, about a quarter have had specialized crisis intervention training.
Because ultimately, we can't really help them. All we can do is connect them with resources that might be able to help them. That's really the thrust of CIT.
It's these kinds of crisis teams that have become a response to the defunding of mental health care across the country, says Laura Usher, a program coordinator at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. Instead of early intervention or preventive care, too often people enter the system once they're in the midst of a crisis.
It's like if we didn't screen for high blood pressure and we didn't screen for high cholesterol and we just waited for people to have heart attacks and then said, oh, okay, I guess this person has heart disease.
Of Idaho's $2.5 billion Department of Health and Welfare budget, just 7.5% went to mental health programs in the last fiscal year. That's a decline from 11% in 2006. Kavanaugh says one result of the cuts is that police departments are now saddled with the cost of crisis care.
The legislature seemed really proud of themselves because they saved all this money at a state level. But all you really did is shift it to the local level, because now instead of calling my counselor or my therapist or changing my medication regime, now it's call 911.
This is John with Mobile Crisis in Boise.
In an Idaho Department of Health and Welfare office, mental health care providers sit in an open room calmly answering crisis calls. John Green is responding to an emergency from a small town outside Boise.
We're trying to figure out what's going on with your brother. Do you know, is he doing okay? Yeah?
He actually did shoot neighbor's cats, or he was attempting to shoot neighbor's cats?
When Green hangs up, he turns to his supervisor, Teresa Shackelford, to devise an action plan. In less than 20 minutes, Green and his colleague, Ellie Merrick, are on the road to meet police officers at the home of the person who's in crisis. After speaking with the man, the officers and social workers agree he needs mental health care, but doesn't meet the strict guidelines for an involuntary mental hold or commitment. Merrick says teams like hers can't always force people to get help.
The bar for civil liberties is intentionally high and should be that way.
The ultimate goal of crisis workers responding to calls like this is to avoid jail and the emergency room and encourage people in crisis to seek long-term care. For Philip Mazaikis, it took being held against his will at the Idaho State Hospital in Blackfoot to come to the realization that he needed medication and ongoing care to live a healthy life with schizophrenia.
My survival has been dependent on others, I think a lot because of my illness, and I'm really thankful for that.
Mazaikis is now on Medicaid, the state federal health insurance program for low-income and disabled children and adults. He isn't able to work, but he is volunteering at the Department of Health and Welfare and recently began the certification process to become a peer support specialist. He hopes to help other Idahoans navigate mental illness. For KBSX News, I'm Emily Ritter-Saunders.
Idaho has thousands of residents struggling with psychiatric disorders, and the entire state has been deemed a mental health provider shortage area by the federal government. Many Idahoans battling mental illness don't get the right kind of care or don't get any care and end up in the hospital, sometimes even multiple times a year. Audrey Dutton is a reporter for the Idaho Statesman, our partner in a series looking at Idaho's fragmented mental health care system. Audrey has set out to understand that revolving door of hospitalization and what some organizations are doing to stop it.
Shauna Irvin has spent a lot of her adult life in and out of hospitals. She would hear voices telling her to hurt herself or become suicidal and need 24-hour psychiatric care.
I got sick about 9 years ago, really sick about 9 years ago, and have been fighting my illness since then. And I have been in West Valley, the hospital, probably 30 times.
Shauna's situation is not unique. Idaho is in the midst of a surge in the number of people whose mental illnesses hit a crisis level that requires hospitalization. Often, they come in through the ER after attempting suicide. Dr. Nino Germain is a psychiatrist who works at a number of local facilities, including Intermountain Hospital, a substance abuse and mental health hospital in Boise. She thinks part of the reason so many Idahoans end up being hospitalized is the low number of psychologists and highly trained therapists in Idaho.
I will discharge teenagers from Intermountain Hospital, depression, anxiety. They've cut themselves. They want to die. The medication is the easy part. The hard part is trying to find a therapist who will get them well quickly and effectively according to what the evidence scientific base is, and then get them on their way.
The crisis has become bad enough that it's overwhelming the courts. Idaho has a system of court-ordered commitments to hospitals for people who are a danger to themselves or others, or who can no longer function due to their schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, extreme depression, or other issues. The number of commitment cases that went through Idaho courts rose by 85% in a recent five-year period. Curtis O'Daniel is one of the people who's been sent to state hospitals by the courts.
I'll start having a panic attack and I can see two-dimensional things on the wall, like demons and skeletons. It just reminds me of a bad acid trip.
Curtis is doing better now, but it took multiple arrests and more visits to hospitals than he can count. The thing is, Curtis says he had pretty good access to mental health care if he wanted it, but he didn't want it. That's true of a lot of Idahoans with mental illness. They don't seek out therapy or medication when things get bad, and sometimes that can land them in the hospital when things get much worse. A lot of times, that reluctance to seek help is because of stigma.
Because you always feel like you gotta hide it and minimize it.
Shauna Irvin sought care, but stigma has hindered her recovery. She internalizes how she is treated.
You are judged, and people don't understand it. But unless you've lived it, you don't understand it, and you are judged.
Shauna just went through a new program at West Valley Medical Center in Caldwell. West Valley launched what's called a partial hospitalization program last October. It fills the gap in services between make an appointment to see a doctor in a month and go to the ER now. Loneliness is a big part of depression, and it's something Shauna has struggled with. She said the intense, all-day, weeks-long West Valley program taught her to reach out, that she doesn't have to be alone.
And so I went to my neighbors who they were hello and goodbye neighbors, and invited them to coffee, and we went to the movies, and I started socializing, which is very unusual for me. I learned those skills here at the partial hospitalization program. I never would have done it without it.
The program isn't a cure-all, and it's only one idea that is being tried in Canyon County. But Amy Hicks, who runs the program, says it was a breakthrough moment when she heard that Shauna is applying for jobs. Shauna hasn't been able to work for a few years now.
I think a lot of people figured that was probably status quo for her, that she would always just be in and out of the hospital, and that was all that we could expect.
As Shauna walked out the door of West Valley in late September on her graduation day from the program, she stopped to say goodbye to Amy Hicks.
Can I have a hug, Amy?
Hicks said that Shauna needed more time in the program than most patients do. But she exemplifies the kind of Idahoan who could benefit from a program that bridges the gap in services.
She's, married, mother of three, and is not the stereotype of mental health issues, but she really is. She is who we normally see. It's everybody. And mental illness affects everyone.
In Boise, I'm Audrey Dutton.
One in three inmates in Idaho's prisons has a mental health issue. The Ada County Jail actually employs mental health providers because there are so many people who are arrested with a psychiatric disorder, often because of that disorder. Almost a decade ago, Idaho started trying to keep some of those offenders out of the system. Counties opened special courts to handle certain cases. Audrey Dutton is a reporter for the Idaho Statesman, our partner for this week's In Crisis series. Audrey visited the special mental health courts and gives us a peek into what they're like.
Shannon Guevara is a 34-year-old who lives in Nampa. Most evenings, you'll find her cooking dinner for her husband, Roman, and four kids, and reminding the kids to do their chores.
Check your chore.
Yep.
Tonight, the family is happy, but it wasn't always. Shannon started using meth about 5 years ago when her family was going through a tough financial time. She knew it was addictive, but she heard it would give her energy. Shannon has bipolar disorder and used meth to keep her from spending an entire week in bed. No showers, no cooking dinner.
Because during that time when everything was happening, I was starting to get really depressed and feel suicidal. And we couldn't afford to go to the doctor at that time, for me too.
The meth didn't help. She got hooked and things got worse. Eventually, she was arrested and jailed, then released.
I ended up trying to commit suicide, and they court-ordered me in the hospital, and the doctors there diagnosed me with bipolar and manic depression. I took pills, but they made me feel like I was a zombie, so then I quit taking them, and I went back to the drugs to try and medicate myself.
Shannon would get clean, go back to drugs, get clean, and so on. She spent a total of almost 2 years in prison. Then, in July, she relapsed again. This time, her husband called the police, and she was arrested. But a district judge looked at Shannon's case and decided to refer her to a special mental health court that offers people with certain psychiatric issues an alternative to prison. About 40 people in Boise and 25 people in Caldwell gather each week in those courts to answer to a judge about their steps toward rehabilitation. Shannon was accepted last month into Canyon County's mental health court.
When you're incarcerated, all you're doing is just sitting there incarcerated. You pretty much are not having to deal with your stress of your normal life out here. And out here with the mental health court, it's going to give me the opportunity to teach me how to deal with life and sort of guide me to where I start being able to do it on my own instead of just throwing me out here and, okay, here, stay sober and do good.
Kelly Jennings is the coordinator for Ada County's mental health court. Many of the people she shepherded through the program in the past 9 years ended up there because they ran out of money for medications and, like Guevara, started using drugs.
I didn't realize how marginalized people were in society who had serious mental illnesses until I started working here. You know, not everybody graduates with an A+. Not everybody sails through the program. That's actually very, very rare. But getting through the program at all for 18 months at least is a big accomplishment.
Ada County Mental Health Court has 4 phases. It also has a pretty good success rate. Graduates are about half as likely to reoffend if they go through the court than if they'd just been on probation. But there's something Jennings says is keeping the courts from being more successful. State funding cuts have meant fewer mental health staffers, and the courts themselves don't have a budget for housing assistance. Defendants can't work in the early stages of recovery, and they aren't allowed to live on the streets.
That might mean that instead of being placed in housing for 6 consecutive months while their meds are becoming stable and while they're getting used to the program, that they end up at a shelter. That can exacerbate your symptoms quite a bit, and it can make it difficult to focus on the business at hand.
The courts can help change lives, says Judge Michael Reardon, who oversees the Ada County Court.
There's a light that goes on for most folks someplace around phase 3 that says, oh, wow, my life's better. This stuff works. Okay, now how do I do that for myself?
Even without having started mental health court yet, Shannon Guevara says it's helping her to not be in prison. She's getting psychiatric care from a doctor finally. She feels hopeful. She's with her family, which is a daily reminder why she needs to get better. She no longer has plans for suicide.
When I got arrested, to me, it was a blessing. I felt a load lifted off my shoulders. I know I'm facing a new charge, and yes, I may end up back in prison, but in the long run, I'm sober. If the judges allow it, I'll get the help through the mental health court, and I think that'll be the help I need.
In Boise, I'm Audrey Dutton.
It's been a year since mental health care services offered through Idaho's Medicaid program were privatized. Medicaid is the federal state program that pays for health insurance for poor and disabled Idahoans. Emily Ritter Saunders reports that since Optum Idaho took over the state's mental health portion of Medicaid, some recipients have seen their services cut back or eliminated.
9-year-old Kendra sits in one of the private rooms on the second floor of Boise's downtown public library with her community-based rehabilitation services worker, Jennifer Beeson. Beeson slides a workbook to Kendra. It's what she calls a feelings journal.
You know, relieved is.
Without missing a beat, Kendra starts to rattle off examples.
Like, you forgot to bring home a paper, mm-hmm. A really, really important paper. And then you brought it home, but you left in your backpack and you thought you left it at school. And then you're relieved that you still have it.
Mm-hmm. For a year and a half, Kendra and Beeson have spent about 4 hours each week developing social and personal skills Kendra falls short on because of a tumultuous start to her life. Kendra was abused and neglected and in foster home by the time she was 3.
No child should go through what she went through.
That's Ginger Kreider, Kendra's adoptive mom.
It put her in severe trauma. She had no coping skills.
That's why Kendra has been receiving community-based rehabilitation, or CBRS, individual counseling, and occupational therapy. They've all been paid for through Medicaid. But Kendra's library appointment was one of her last CBRS sessions. That's because Optum is deliberately cutting or eliminating one of Idaho's most used behavioral health services, CBRS, also known as psychosocial rehabilitation. Becky DiVittorio is Optum Idaho's executive director.
It's important to reemphasize the transformation the state is doing to focus care on the use of more evidence-based practices.
She repeats an often used line as the company has faced criticism from service providers and lawmakers during the bumpy first year of Optum's 3-year contract. The state and Optum say that overhauling the behavioral health portion of Idaho's Medicaid program won't be smooth, but say it will be worth it. both anticipate better care through evidence-based treatment. But Ginger Kreider says CBRS has been a big reason Kendra is improving.
They tackle every life event you think to prepare her for when she gets older. If we don't take care of the kids now, then it's going to cost a lot more money to rehabilitate them as adults.
While Kendra has a long list of diagnoses, Optum's medical director says community-based rehabilitation isn't the right treatment for her. It could even be hurting her progress in forming a bond with her new family. Instead, Optum recommends that Kreider enrolls in family therapy and parenting classes. Optum has increased the use of individual and family therapy over the last year, but it has also cut CBRS by 10%. As Kendra's case highlights, Optum and the state believe there are Idahoans who've been getting the wrong treatment. Even the service providers acknowledge that CBRS has been used as a one-size-fits-all solution. A big reason, they say, is that Medicaid in Idaho hasn't been willing to pay for alternatives.
A lot of the treatment programs, et cetera, just weren't brought in. And so that is a valid criticism, I think.
State Representative Fred Wood, himself a physician, is a Republican from Burley who chairs the Idaho House Health and Welfare Committee.
But that's the past. And just because that was the way we used to do it and it was wrong doesn't mean that that's the way we ought to do it in the future.
Community-based rehabilitation is the appropriate treatment for someone diagnosed with schizophrenia, according to the American Psychological Association. So it was a shock to Teresa Kozierzinski and her providers when she nearly lost her CBRS. 28-year-old Teresa has schizoaffective disorder. It's a mix of bipolar and schizophrenia. She's been in and out of Idaho's state hospitals since she was 15. Teresa and her CBRS worker, Kristen Cordero, sit at a picnic table at a Boise park working through her monthly finances.
I just got a raise, right?
So how much do you think you're going to need? Because you're also going to have to get food because now you don't have food stamps.
Teresa has told her caregivers the near constant voices in her head make her aggressive. That's why she can't work. Instead, she lives off Social Security disability. Teresa spends 6 hours a week with Cordero to learn how to better function in the community.
If she didn't see me, she would never leave her apartment. She would isolate to her apartment, and that would make it worse.
Cordero is one of four service providers who see her each week. Every 3 months, Teresa's services are up for review by Optum, and every 3 months, she and Cordero worry a change in services could have a big impact on Teresa's fragile situation.
I think my sense of security would go down because if something bad happened, who would I go to?
Teresa doesn't have family in Idaho. Her community-based rehabilitation, individual therapy, medication management, and in-home personal care, while not perfect, have kept her safe and out of the hospital. But it's a life wholly reliant on a state system in flux. For KBSX News, I'm Emily Ritter-Saunders.